You are listening to WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign. This has been the WEFT Courier for Wednesday. Join us again tomorrow for Democracy Now! At 4 p.m., Making Contact at 5, and Counterspin at 5:30. And now it's time for the Midwatch.
By the guns of market-hungry military profiteers, whose word is a swamp and whose brow is smeared with the blood of the poor. We rob life of its quality, we render rage a necessity, by turning countries into labor camps, modern slavers and dragons champions of freedom. Sinister, cynical instrument who makes the gun into a sacrament. The only response to the deification of tyranny by so-called developed nations, idolatry of ideology. North, south, east, west, kill the best and buy the rest. It's just spend a buck to make a buck. You don't really give a flying about the people in misery. IMF, dirty IMF, takes away everything it can get. Always making certain that there's one thing left. Keep them on the hook with insupportable debt. The ladies shake hands with the fellas, and it's open for business like a cheap bordello, and they call it democracy, and they call it democracy, and they call it democracy, and they call it democracy. You see the loaded eyes of the children too, trying to make the best of it the way kids do. One day you're gonna rise from your habitual feast to find yourself staring down the throat of the beast they call a revolution. IMF, dirty IMF, takes away everything it can get. Always make it certain that there's one thing left. Keep them on the hook with insupportable debt. They call it democracy. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy. And they call it democracy.
And that was Bruce Coburn with Call It Democracy. Either Reasonable Man Stan had a sex change, or I'm Not Reasonable Man Stan. And it is the latter, I'm Not Reasonable Man Stan. He is taking some time off from the Midwatch and is graciously allowing me to be his substitute for him. My name is Nisi Shizenji. And I am really excited to be doing this. I subbed for Stan once before and found it to be just a really great experience, and I'm delighted to be doing it again. We're going to be covering a lot of different issues, many of them ones that Stan himself would be talking about. I know what we're talking about tonight. Stan said he thought this was something that needs to be heard and known more broadly throughout the community. So I feel good about devoting this time on the Midwatch to this topic because it has Stan's personal stamp of approval. So we are going to be talking about medical marijuana, the laws in Illinois, some of the struggles to get where we are right now, some of the challenges that remain. It's going to be a wide-ranging, I think very informative and important conversation. And my special guest is a gentleman named Dan Lynn. Hi, Dan.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
I'm delighted to have you here. I'm going to talk a little bit about your cannabis cred because it is very significant, and I want our listeners to know really who you are and in terms of your professional life and some of the things that you are credited with doing, okay?
Thank you.
So Dan has been an cannabis activist since the early 2000s and has had a lot of influence in the state of Illinois in terms of bringing us to where we are right now. After a medical cannabis bill sponsored by the late state representative Larry McKeon was defeated in an Illinois House Healthcare Availability and Access Committee, Dan worked directly with lawmakers, patients, doctors, and other advocates to push this issue to the forefront of Illinois political discourse. Getting to know patients over the long drive to and from the Capitol and guiding them through the legislative process, he became a trusted source for patients to learn the political realities of what it would take to pass a medical cannabis bill in Illinois. Between 2008 and 2010, he was awarded over $75,000 in grant funding to organize a grassroots movement and lobby for the passage of a medical cannabis bill. In 2009, he founded the Illinois Cannabis Patients Association to organize and lobby on behalf of medical cannabis patients in Illinois, who at that time were considered criminals. That same year, Dan successfully lobbied the passage of Senate Bill 1381 through the Illinois Senate, only to fall 10 votes short in the House. During this period, Dan's work influenced the Illinois State Police to go neutral on the legislation. Dan can be directly attributed with the sunset clause that makes the medical cannabis program a pilot program as a concession to secure passage, shifting the number of dispensaries from 59 to 60, proposing a previous title of the legislation, and securing the needed 30th vote in the 2009 SB 1381 Senate passage. Dan is a leading medical cannabis advocate for the entire state of Illinois. He has testified before committees at the Capitol in Springfield, been published and quoted in numerous newspapers and news broadcasts in Illinois, is a co-author of the book The Cannabis Papers, and has been a leading voice for ending cannabis prohibition in Illinois. He's also a founding board member of the Illinois Cannabis Industry Association, and as of about, I think, a month ago, could you tell us what your title is, please?
Yes, well, thank you for that wonderful biography. It's interesting to think of all the time that it took to get there. But about a month ago, I was brought on as the National Policy Director for Phoenix Farms of Illinois, who are going to be operating the medical cannabis dispensary in Champaign, which will be known as Phoenix Botanical.
Okay. Awesome. Is there anything you would like to add in terms of your bio? Because, folks, believe me, I did not list everything that this gentleman has done, is doing, and that it can be credited for. Is there something that you think I should definitely, our listeners should know about?
I would just add that I was a personal assistant to a quadriplegic friend of mine, and I think that gives me a little bit of insight into what patients are going through and what caregivers are going through as well.
Okay. All right. So could you just talk a little bit about how you got started on this particular path in your life and your career?
Sure. It really started when I was in high school and we had a history class teaching us about alcohol prohibition and the Roaring Twenties and gangsters and corruption, Al Capone. And immediately following my history class, I had a public health class, and they were teaching us about drugs and drug abuse and trying to prevent us from experimenting with drugs. And they equated all drugs as being equally bad, and that is why they were illegal. And it was easy for me to draw a parallel between alcohol prohibition and the Noble experiment and why it didn't work, and this new prohibition that we had with the war on drugs. And I couldn't really get a good answer about, you know, why they made cannabis illegal in the first place. So I started doing research reports, writing speeches, pro-con debates. And then when I went off to college, I started doing longer research reports and longer speeches. And after investigating how they made cannabis illegal in this country, it became very clear to me that people just don't know why they made this plant illegal. Mm-hmm. And if they did, there's a good chance that this plant wouldn't be illegal. So I started volunteering with the Illinois chapter of Normal. I started going to meetings in Chicago, and was kind of surprised at how few people were politically active for the legalization movement in the big city of Chicago. At the time, my brother had just finished up running for state representative, so I had really learned how easy it is to get involved in state and local politics, and I started telling the folks in Chicago, we need to be more active in Springfield if we're actually going to change this law. And people told me, well, this is a duocracy. If you want something done, you got to do it yourself, basically. Right. So I started going to Springfield, talking to the lawmakers, talking to whatever media outlets would listen to me, and eventually started bringing patients down to the Capitol to testify about how medical cannabis was helping them, or how they wanted to have access to this medicine that people in California had access to, oftentimes bringing a Ziploc bag full of prescription pills that they were taking and talking about the different side effects and how they have to take this pill to overcome the side effects of that pill, and they still weren't getting the relief. And it really surprised me at how long it took for us to get medical cannabis in Illinois and to not consider these patients criminals anymore, and to get them safe and legal access to this medicine.
What do you think that resistance was about?
Well, there's definitely resistance from the law enforcement community. That was the biggest challenge that we faced at the Capitol. There was also some family values groups, I would say, that opposed us. You know, people that get funding from the National Institute on Drug Abuse, Partnership for Drug Free America, those type of groups. But the reality, I think, was that the political will just wasn't there yet. Mm-hmm. Even lawmakers that would, in private conversations, admit that they didn't think these patients were criminals, or that they wanted to vote for this bill, but they just couldn't because of the potential election that they would face the next time around. That was very disappointing. I know it broke a lot of those patients' hearts that we brought to the Capitol.
Sure.
But between the political will to actually get this done and the resistance from the law enforcement community, I think that those were the two biggest obstacles and why it took us basically a decade to get this law.
But you did manage to get the Illinois State Police to at least be neutral.
Yeah, and I think that that was partially because at the time we were actually looking like might actually pass this bill, and it might end up on the governor's desk, and the governor didn't want to sign a bill that his own branch of law enforcement was actively opposing. So we really think that there was just the governor's marching orders to tell them to go neutral. And then eventually we did actually tie the cultivation center licensing to each state police district. So not only do with their concerns addressed, but now they actually have a little bit of skin in the game in terms of making sure that those cultivation centers are secure and not selling out the back door.
Ah, okay. So they're involved. I mean, they're...
Yeah, the cultivation centers and the dispensaries all have cameras that have live streaming to the state police departments.
Okay, I did not know that. You said that you became interested in the history of cannabis and specifically the history of the criminalization, which is something I really am itching to talk about, if that's something you'd like to talk about.
I think we need to talk about it because, like I said, they didn't teach us in history class how they made cannabis illegal. They just taught us about how they made alcohol illegal, and then 13 years later, they reversed course on it.
So if you don't mind, I'm going to just highlight some points in history for our listeners, and I'm going to ask you to chime in and fill in details as you see fit.
My pleasure.
Okay, so in the earliest part of this nation's history from the 1600s and well into the late 1800s, the domestic production of hemp was encouraged. And in fact, in 1619, the Virginia Assembly passed legislation requiring every farmer to grow hemp. And it was even legal tender in Pennsylvania, Virginia, and Maryland. And it was grown because it could be used in the production of rope sails, sails as in sails on a boat, clothing, etc. Domestic production, from my research, flourished until after the Civil War, and then imports and other domestic materials began to replace hemp for many purposes. In the late 19th century, marijuana was a very popular ingredient in many medicinal products and was sold openly in public pharmacies. I don't think that's something that a lot of people know.
No, and I think, and just to be clear, you know, marijuana, cannabis, hemp, they're all the same plant.
Yes.
They are grown differently, and hemp is often referred to as the industrial version of this plant.
Yes.
That doesn't have any psychoactive components. You can smoke a pound of it, and you're not going to get high or any type of therapeutic benefit.
You're going to get a headache.
Yes. And, you know, cannabis and the term marijuana are generally used to refer to the psychoactive versions or strains of the plant. But, yeah, I mean, the medical applications of cannabis before they made it illegal, in fact, was that it was one of the most widely prescribed medicines during the patent medicine era. And while we know that those medicines, not all of them were safe, not all of them were what they said they were, that's why we have an FDA now. But if you look at the history of the usage of this plant, either for industrial purposes or for medical purposes, it has a long history before the current era that we're in with states passing medical cannabis laws in this country.
My understanding is that this is probably one of the oldest cultivated plants on Earth.
Yeah, if you look at the records in ancient China, they were using this for therapeutic purposes. The ancient Egyptians, I believe, were using it for industrial purposes. Even the word cannabis comes from canvas. You know, those are the similar for the reason that so much of that canvas was produced from industrial hemp.
Now, so you said that the while it may kind of have the same hemp and marijuana may have root is not the word I want to use may have originated in the same wild plant at one point in time.
Yes.
There was a divergence where one plant being hemp is really cultivated more for industrial purposes, and then cannabis more for medicinal and spiritual practices in many parts of the world. And my understanding is that today it's the THC content that determines. So I just came up with this. Go ahead and
answer
that.
THC is a cannabinoid, which is one of the plant compounds found in the cannabis plant. It is the one that gets people high. It gives people the euphoric effect. Industrial hemp generally is understood to have less than 1% THC, or in a lot of cases, less than 0.3% THC. And that's why it doesn't have those psychoactive components. And as you mentioned, over centuries of people cultivating this plant, even if you look at the way that industrial hemp is grown, they plant it very close together. It's almost like a bamboo or a switchgrass type of crop where it grows very tall and very thin. Anybody who's growing cannabis for the psychoactive purposes or medical benefits, they're generally looking to grow the flowers of the plant, which would then make it much more of like a bush-like plant or a Christmas tree. And there's going to be a lot of space in between those plants so that those flowers can grow and flourish. Whereas the industrial purposes, they're really looking for the fiber that's in that stalk that's going to be long and thin and tall, or they're looking for the seeds that'll be in the flowers at the top of that long and tall plant.
I read that in Canada, which does grow hemp, and in fact the production of hemp is ever expanding in Canada, that the maximum THC content is 0.3%.
Exactly. And if you look at a lot of the consumer goods dealing with hemp in this country because they're all legal. You can purchase hemp consumer goods at any natural grocery store. You can find the cordage and canvas materials at different eco-friendly clothing stores. And all of those raw materials are produced in other countries that we import into the U.S., and then we refine them or turn them into the T-shirts or the other stuff. But the vast majority of the hemp food products come from Canada. The canvas and cordage materials, that generally comes from Eastern Europe or China, who's a very large producer of hemp still.
Because it is illegal to grow hemp.
In the United States of America, it is illegal to grow hemp with some exceptions.
Okay.
There are states that have legalized not just industrial hemp, but also recreational cannabis like Colorado that are currently growing hemp. The state of Kentucky is leading the way in hemp production. In the, I believe it was the 2014 federal farm bill, they had language in that bill that allowed for states to move forward with industrial hemp production so long as their Department of Agriculture licensed who was producing it. Whereas previously states could do that, but they needed to get DEA approval for those licenses. And most people that are paying attention know that the DEA was just never giving up any of
right.
those licenses. They would never issue them. But with that language in the farm bill, it gave sort of a yellow light to move forward in states that want to do this, but the liberal haven of Kentucky is now leading the way in industrial hemp farming, quickly followed behind Colorado and North Dakota.
That does surprise me that Kentucky, but okay, not knowing, I'm an avid gardener, but I do not know how to grow hemp. But it has occurred to me in the past that places that successfully grow tobacco might be good places to successfully grow hemp.
Yeah, and for what it's worth, industrial hemp is such a versatile crop that it basically grows anywhere in just
okay.
about any place. I think that's really where the term weed comes from.
Yeah.
And for I believe it's still the case in Illinois. It's actually listed under the noxious weed statute in Illinois. And for what it's worth, the last time that the national government of the United States of America actually allowed industrial hemp farming, they actually encouraged it during World War II during the Hemp for Victory campaign.
Uh-huh.
And you can look up you can find that video on YouTube of the patriotic duty of farmers growing hemp. And Illinois actually led the country in hemp production during that World War II effort. And you can still find hemp growing in Illinois along the railroad lines from where it fell off of those rail cars in the 40s. The seeds have been reseeding themselves for decades
ever since. Wow.
And if you talk to farmers or people that live by railroad lines, they'll tell you that that ditch weed still grows out there. And that's just stuff that has been reseeding itself since the World War II effort.
That's a hardy crop.
Yeah, and I think that's where, you know, people maybe have these misconceptions that anybody can just grow cannabis and be an expert farmer at it. That may be true of industrial hemp, but somebody who's looking to grow cannabis for medical purposes, for spiritual purposes, it does take a little bit more of a finesse from a gardener's standpoint.
My understanding, too, I just was reading that during World War II, if you were growing hemp, you would have a deferment from military service. You didn't have to go fight because your part of the war effort was growing hemp.
I didn't know that, but yeah. I could definitely see it because of how much they encouraged it as part of that patriotic duty, just like they did with Victory Gardens.
Yes.
Which is something that I really wish our country would bring back and foster this idea of we'll all be better off if we're producing even just a little bit of our own food. You know, whether it's reducing greenhouse gas emissions, whether it's reducing the inputs that require vegetables to be grown in this country. You know, there's certain things that we did during that World War II effort that I think we should revisit and see why we aren't doing them anymore, because I think it was a great use of public policy dollars and PSAs.
By the way, I'm hoping for that to be a future show. I'm hoping to do one on the whole concept of urban agriculture and community gardens and et cetera, et cetera.
I love it. I facilitate the community garden in my neighborhood in Springfield. So,
awesome.
I could talk for hours about that topic as well.
I might have you back.
Yeah.
All right. So, again, now looking back at the history, we were talking about cannabis being available and sold in public pharmacies. Then in 1906, the Pure Food and Drug Act was passed, and that required labeling of any cannabis that was contained in over-the-counter remedies. Then, and this is where I find that it gets really interesting, and I think most people don't realize this unless they are a person who's studied it. We weren't taught it, as you said. After the Mexican Revolution of 1910, lots of Mexican immigrants began coming into the United States, and the Mexican immigrants were the ones that introduced the recreational use of marijuana to American culture. And the drug became associated with these Spanish-speaking Mexican immigrants, and it was really fear and prejudice against those folks that led to kind of a hysteria about the marijuana menace.
Yeah, and then, you know, just as, you know, a side note to that, the other culture that was really using cannabis in those days were the jazz clubs.
Yes.
And you were starting 30s. To see this intermingling of the races at these jazz clubs, and, you know, they're smoking this cannabis stuff, and they're getting along. They're not starting fights with each other, and that was something that they, you know, that society was just, you know, the powers that be just weren't happy with that, and they weren't going to allow that to be. And, you know, that word marijuana is a slang term, kind of a derogatory term used to describe those Mexican farm workers, those migrants that were consuming this product. Yet now people use it regularly to describe this plant material, and very few people actually call it by cannabis, which is the scientific name.
You know, when I was reading about this, the anti-cannabis campaigners at that time, just listen to this, folks. Tell me if this sounds familiar at all to someone who is espousing the same kind of blankety-blank-blank today. Things like these Mexicans are committing terrible crimes, sexual violence, robberies, blah, blah, blah. I don't know. That sounds like somebody we know today who shall remain unnamed. Yes, then during the 1930s, you had jazz musicians, and I may actually play a tune or two later from these jazz musicians. They're pretty fun songs.
Yeah, some Cab Calloway. Louis Armstrong.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think a lot of people realize that Louis Armstrong
was one of the original advocates of cannabis in this country.
Yes, and I think a lot of people don't realize that because we became accustomed to thinking of him as a very friendly, smiling face on American TV, not at all associated with that menace.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. So in 1930, we had the creation of the Federal Bureau of Narcotics, and the first commissioner of the FBN was Harry J. Anslinger. He remained in that post until 1962. And I really, just in case we aren't getting how racist this was, I'm going to read some quotes.
Oh, boy.
And, these are really quite something to read. So this is Anslinger, quote, "There are 100,000 total marijuana smokers in the U.S., and most are Negroes, Hispanics, Filipinos, and entertainers. Their satanic music, jazz, and swing result from marijuana use. This marijuana causes white women to seek sexual relations with Negroes, entertainers, and any others." He also said, "Reefer makes darkies think they're as good as white men." He also said that marijuana is more, quote, "more dangerous than heroin or cocaine and leads to pacifism and communist brainwashing." Again, quoting, "If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with marijuana, he would drop dead of fright."
I don't know what's scarier there, Frankenstein or Frankenstein dropping dead from this satanic plant. You know, you can't find any politician who supports cannabis prohibition today who will stand by those words. And that is the foundation of how they made this plant illegal, was that type of fear-mongering.
Absolutely.
Combined with a lot of yellow journalism from another, I don't want to call him a gentleman, but another fella at that time, whose name was William Randolph Hearst, who owned a bunch of newspapers, and part of his newspaper investments also included forestry investments, and industrial hemp, which is a renewable resource that can be grown every single year and cut down and made into paper, really competed with his market share for his forestry investments for that paper production for his newspapers, where, you know, the trees in the forestry industry, they take years to grow before you can harvest them for paper, right. Whereas industrial hemp, you can grow that year after year. You'll actually produce a lot more paper from 1 acre of hemp than you will for, I believe it's 1 acre of hemp will produce the equivalent of 4 acres of trees when it comes to paper production.
Wow.
And then also to consider that time period, we were just at the tail end of alcohol prohibition. You know, alcohol prohibition ends in 1933. You have this whole bureaucracy of Elliot Nesses and people that were going after the bootleggers and the gangsters. All of a sudden they repeal alcohol prohibition. And you have this bureaucracy of people who were enforcing it that now need work.
Yep.
And one of the things about bureaucracy, and it's still true today, is that it's a very unwielding beast that you can't downsize it ever. It only grows. And it was 4 short years from the end of alcohol prohibition to 1937 when they made cannabis illegal. And that's where, you know, you see this bureaucracy just kind of shifting from demonizing one substance to another, albeit, you know, they went from a product that was somewhat more processed through fermentation or distillation to now a plant that really is as processed as any other vegetable that we're considered that we're consuming today.
My understanding is that even prior to the federal level in 1937, that a lot of states in the South were passing laws against marijuana as part of their Jim Crow.
Yeah, and that's where you see that racist foundation of these state laws is really what drove it. It wasn't that there was a public outcry of people who, you know, felt that this satanic plant or this menace was burdening their lives. It was, you know, a lot of fear-mongering and people with a vested interest. The other industries that really stood to lose a lot of money or market share were the synthetic fibers that were just starting to come on board. The polyesters that we know today were just starting to be developed by DuPont and Dow Chemical. And as you'd mentioned, with industrial hemp, that was what a lot of our fabric and clothing was made out of at the time. The first pair of jeans were made out of industrial hemp because hemp is mold and mildew resistant, which is not true of cotton or jute or other fabrics that we use to make clothing, I'd say.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, I mean, it's this perfect storm of industries that saw that they were going to lose a lot of money that were able to really scapegoat cannabis and its industrial hemp counterpart and make it illegal. And almost 80 years now, we still have this prohibition. We still are not reducing the usage of cannabis. And young people who we try and keep away from it are the ones that have the best access of it, because no drug dealer, no cannabis seller that's, you know, other than like a legal one at a medical cannabis dispensary, none of them card. None of them care how old you are. High schoolers consistently report it's easier for them to get cannabis than it is for them to get alcohol.
Yeah, yeah. Now, I'm just going to mention a couple more things, and then I'm going to take a bit of a pause for us to do some pitching for pledges, because we are in our spring pledge drive. What I wanted to mention was, lest we think that that racism that's in at the root of the criminalization of cannabis has ended, it has not. According to a 2013 study by the American Civil Liberties Union, blacks across the nation were nearly 4 times more likely than whites to be arrested on charges of marijuana possession in 2010, despite data that suggests that the rate of drug use is about the same between blacks and whites. And in fact, among the youth, more white kids are smoking than black kids. But they're not being arrested at the same rate, and that, in fact, in some states, blacks are up to 6 times more likely to be arrested. In all, around 750,000 people are arrested for marijuana use each year, and more than 650,000 of them for possession alone. So this is a commonplace arrest for simple marijuana possession, and it has rippling, damaging effects, especially in minority communities. Anyone convicted of possession of a controlled substance under federal or state law forfeits their eligibility for any federal grant, loan, or work assistance, meaning that a dime bag could cost a hopeful teen his shot at an affordable higher education.
Yeah, and that's the real tragedy there. You're punishing that teenager twice.
Yeah.
Once for being in violation of, you know, the possession of the controlled substance, and oh, by the way, your future dreams of going to college and getting a scholarship or grant money, they're going to take that away too.
Yeah. And again, I'm going to underscore this because I think it's essential. If you're a black teen, you're four times more likely, or in some states, six times more likely to have that happen to you than your white.
Yeah, and I know we got to take a break, but I'd like to talk about the decriminalization efforts that have happened and why we are still seeing that racial disparity in arrest, even in cities like Chicago that have decriminalized cannabis.
Okay, we will talk about that as soon as I get finished saying we are in Spring Pledge Drive. If you're enjoying what you're hearing, and I know you enjoy hearing Reasonable Man Stan talk about public affairs and politics and investment every week, hopefully you're enjoying this conversation. I know you enjoy the fact that you don't get the kind of news and public affairs programming on any commercial radio station or even public radio station that you get on WEFT. You just don't. And this is something that we really hope you value. If you do value it, you have to understand that without you, because we are community supported, without you, this goes away. So don't let it go away. You want to continue to hear these kinds of locally produced public affairs programs as well as nationally produced programs that we play, such as Democracy Now. So give us a call, 359-6545, to make your pledge. We do actually have folks standing by right now that can take your call. You can also go to weft.org and make your pledge there. But we really need to hear from you. We have a goal of $30,000 for this spring pledge drive, and we are about a third of the way there, and we really need to hear from you. Please support WEFT. We support you, and we need to kind of complete this circle so that we make sure that we stick around. All right, Dan, you were going to be talking about the decriminalization and racism.
Yes, so, and this is a very timely subject, because even this morning, the General Assembly passed an Senate committee a bill that would make this a uniform decriminalization state. That bill obviously just passed a committee this morning. It's not law yet, but over 100 municipalities in Illinois have a local ordinance violation where police officers can issue a ticket to somebody in possession of low-level amounts of cannabis. Chicago is one of those cities. And, you know, the Illinois chapter of Normal and others helped draft that ordinance and help push it. But what we've seen with ordinances like that is that they always have some problematic language of allowing the officer to use their discretion, whether they want to issue a ticket under city ordinance violation or if they want to arrest and charge somebody under the state law.
Oh.
And we knew this, you know, once when we couldn't get away from it, we knew that it was going to turn into this where you have wealthy white or suburban white kids who are getting these tickets and low-income minorities are the ones getting arrested. Even if those charges, after they've been arrested, end up getting dropped in court, they still have that arrest on their record. They're fingerprinted. They're booked at the station. And we've seen it as sort of a sweeping the streets effort from law enforcement where they just want to get these young minorities in the database, in the criminal justice system's database so that they can hopefully solve some other crime is their logic with it once when they know who these individuals are and they have their fingerprints on record. But that was something that we knew going into it with this type of problematic language. And we've tried to avoid it, obviously, because we knew that this was going to be an issue. Yet it's very difficult to take away any type of power from the law enforcement community.
Sure.
And they already have discretion to arrest people. They can already, you know, detain you for 24 hours. Yet we know that it's easier for them if they find someone in a small amount of cannabis to just write a ticket. It takes about 4 hours for them to process somebody from the time that they arrest them to going to the station, going through the fingerprints, going through the photos, filling out the paperwork. And in at least Chicago and Cook County, what was happening even before this ordinance was ever passed was these individuals would show up to court and the judge would order anybody that was there for, I believe it was 15 grams or less of cannabis, to come to the front, and they would just dismiss all those charges.
Mm-hmm.
But now that we have this decriminalization ordinance in Chicago and other municipalities, you know, those law enforcement officers can write that ticket. The individual forfeits the cannabis, obviously, and then they're on their way. And this was something that we were also concerned about, was that it would turn into almost a fundraising effort for law enforcement. If they can just, you know, actively enforce this law more, they can write more tickets, and then it goes all into the city coffers. Because what was happening with the arrest method was that they would arrest somebody, they would take them to the city jail or the county jail, they would charge them under state law, but when they did go to court, any fines that they paid went to the county or to the state itself, whereas now that city police officer can write the ticket and those fines go to the city coffers.
Okay.
And like a city like Aurora, which is, I believe, is still the second most populated city in Illinois, that was the main motivation for why they decriminalized cannabis in 2008, I believe. And it was pushed by a city council member that had a law enforcement background. And that was what he told me when I asked him why he did this, was, you know, these fines are going to the county and the state. If they do get a fine issued, we want to keep that money in the city coffers. So you see this as sort of a way for them to keep that money where the law enforcement officers that are doing the work can get paid from.
And can you clarify, because I think there can be confusion about this, the difference between decriminalization and legalization?
Absolutely. And some people use those terms interchangeably. I don't think that that's wise. I think that there is a significant difference. With legalization, you have regulated sales. You have no criminal penalties for responsible use. And, you know, we could spend all day talking about what is responsible use versus what is not responsible use of this substance. Whereas with decriminalization, it almost always involves a low-level amount of possession, you know, 2.5 grams, 10 grams, 15 grams, 30 grams in some cities, where the individual who's found in possession of that amount forfeits the cannabis and is issued a ticket, again, under city law usually, and then that fine is paid to the city. It's not where you get arrested and have a criminal record from decriminalization, but yet the product is still illegal. There's no regulated sellers. There's no regulated production. There's no quality controls. And the, you know, the underground market still exists there. The gangs and the organized crime syndicates are the ones who can still control that, production and distribution aspect of it. Whereas with legalization, you have those regulated sales. You have that ability to tax this product as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas decriminalization essentially amounts to a de facto tax, where you like to smoke cannabis, you are in possession of cannabis, now you got to pay $50, $100, $200, and you forfeit the cannabis.
Okay. How much is 15 grams? Like, if you were to say that's equals this number of marijuana cigarettes or joints, what would that be?
The average cigarette, I would say, is a little over or a little under a gram.
And we've got a caller. I'm going to go ahead and take this call. Just a moment, please. Hello, you're on the air. Hello? I think I didn't get to you fast enough, caller, so if you want to try again. Wait, nope, you're there. Are you there?
Nope. Yeah, I'm here.
Okay, awesome. Sorry, it took me a minute to get you here.
Excellent. This is Robert Essex.
Oh, excellent. Hi, Robert.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. Do you have a question or a comment, something you'd like to say?
Actually, yeah. How, like, you guys still there?
Yep, we're here.
Okay.
Turn down your radio, by the way. If you have your radio where you can hear it, you need to turn it down.
Absolutely, absolutely.
Okay, thanks.
Hey, I was just calling. I run a smoke shop in town, and I was curious to know how language, language is an issue for us in a lot of smoke shops. We have to play like a bit of a dance to explain some of the things that we need to explain to people who are coming in to buy tobacco products, whether it be like rolling papers or you know,
glassware
and stuff like that. And I'm really wondering, where does that, is there actually some kind of legislation on that type of stuff, or is this something that's like kind of dictated by the city or the local ordinance, or where does that information come from, or where does that decision come from?
That's a good question.
There is a law on the books in Illinois that is the Drug Paraphernalia Act. And in that act, you find what I think to be very colorful language, because I never thought that you'd have lawyers or lawmakers debating terms like chillums or bongs. But in the actual statutes of Illinois in the Drug Paraphernalia Act, it does list things like bongs and chillums as these devices that are used to illegally consume or otherwise assist in the consumption of illegal products, and that's why shops like yourself aren't allowed to use those terms when you're selling this glassware, and that's why they really emphasize that this is for tobacco use only. There are efforts to change that. I know that with one of the bills that was filed to legalize cannabis, it actually removed the word cannabis from the Drug Paraphernalia Act so that those products could be sold for the usage with cannabis. Obviously, we would need that bill to pass into a law before that would apply to your business. But that's really where those terms come from and where those restrictions on the language that you can or cannot say in your store come from would be that Drug Paraphernalia Act.
Robert, do you find that to be an inhibitor in your ability to conduct business on a daily basis?
You know, we're fairly clever, and we kind of can, in terms of our language in the store, you know, we can really work around most terms that we can't say. I just always think, especially with, like, you know, medical marijuana or medical cannabis coming online, if that's going to enable us to kind of lean back on some of those languages and making it a little bit easier for people to understand and explain these simple things to people without having to play the dance. And sometimes it's a little hard to control your customers because some people kind of take offense that, you know, they come into a store and they're immediately told, you know, you have to watch what you're saying. Some people just aren't aware. You know, some of the older cat heads, they understand and they get it. But I think, like, the younger generation kids kind of don't get it and they kind of take offense to it. They really don't. You know, it makes them uncomfortable, and that could possibly, you know, hurt our relationship with them.
Yeah, I know that there have been some talks about trying to allow for, you know, medical cannabis devices to be sold in stores like yourself, and not necessarily just in these medical cannabis dispensaries. I haven't seen any real momentum on that or any real changes with it, but I do think it's a very worthwhile discussion to have, because now that medical cannabis is legal in Illinois, these devices can assist in patients using this medicine. There's no reason why you should need to use some type of code or gray area language in order to sell these products to these patients who are abiding by state law.
Robert, there was a shop in Indianapolis, and a huge sign as soon as you walk in, and it says, if something like, I'm paraphrasing, if you even begin to hint at the possibility that any of our products can be used for anything other than tobacco consumption, you will be asked to leave the store.
Absolutely.
And you're right. When you as a business have to come across heavy-handed like that, that can be a little off-putting to someone coming in. Maybe I'll just back on out of here so I don't say something wrong.
Yeah, and I'd like to see us like any other business in your town. You know, like, you know, if I was selling shoes, you know, would those same restrictions be acceptable? You know, if I was selling something, you know, different, would it be acceptable to kind of pigeonhole a business kind of that way
Yeah, I don't think that there's any other real products out there that face similar type of restrictions or doing that same type of a dance that the tobacco accessories and paraphernalia have to do in our current system in Illinois or even in other states. I think that that's all something that we'll probably see addressed in the next few years across the country, because more people are starting to be aware that medical cannabis can be beneficial. You know, we're seeing more and more states pass these laws. We're going to see more states pass recreational cannabis laws, and there's no reason that tobacco shops and glassware shops shouldn't be able to thrive just like any other business that would benefit from a change in these laws.
So, Dan, would lobbying of some sort by folks who own these shops make any difference, or political activism of some kind?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's always room for improvement in our laws. You know, I would never discourage somebody from being politically active. I think that that's something that is also part of our patriotic duty in this country. I don't think that there is any type of organization amongst tobacco retailers in Illinois or glassware smoke shops. You know, if we saw some type of industry association that could put funds together and then use that type of leverage to lobby and influence elections, you know, that'd be the first few steps of making this a better law.
There's an idea for you, Robert.
Well, we'll get working on that right away.
All right. Do you have any other questions for Dan?
No. Thanks so much for your time, guys. Appreciate it.
All right. Thank you very much for calling. Take care. Yeah, I think that is very interesting, the dance that has to be done and the potential damage to customer relationships that can happen as a result.
Yeah, and the thing about the glassware industry, that's an industry that's thriving and providing work and financial support for artists. You know, these are glass blowers. This is a artisan trade that really doesn't exist very much anymore. Yeah. I mean, I know that there are still, machines that make some of these products on a much more industrial and large scale basis. But if we're talking about small scale artisan glass blowers, you know, these people need to put food on the table as well. Why are we stifling not only their ability to make money, but in some ways also their creativity?
Yeah.
You know, let these artists have a fair shot at the market just like any other person that's trying to do good and provide a living.
Well, you mentioned medical marijuana, and that was really my next question. If you could kind of outline the history of the effort, kind of the path to where we currently are, where we do have medical marijuana legal. Is that correct?
Yes.
In Illinois. Tell us a bit about that, please.
Sure. And because you'd mentioned the late state representative Larry McKeon, I think that that's a real good place to start with this and to honor his legacy in a lot of ways, because he did lay the foundation for our current law, and every patient in Illinois does owe a debt of gratitude to him, even though he's now deceased. Larry McKeon was a gay man from Chicago who had AIDS, and he would testify about how one of his former lovers died from what's known as the wasting syndrome. And this is where the body just starts slowly shutting down. You can't get food down. You can't keep it down if you do. And he would get up there and really just pour out his heart and give some really heart-wrenching testimony about what he saw his lover go through with this and how cannabis was the only thing that would help him. And that was where, you know, that state representative couldn't get that bill out of a committee, which is, you know, the first step in about an 8-step process to change a law. And that was something that really struck me, you know, was that this man was up there testifying in front of his colleagues, and you'd have the opposition, which at the time would have been the drug czar, come into the state of Illinois just to testify against this. They would talk about how, you know, medical cannabis is no different than medical crack cocaine. And in some cases, the drug czar wouldn't even stick around to hear the vote or the testimony from the patients. And, you know, to kind of fast forward a little bit, Larry McKeon did not end up getting this bill through. He never got it out of committee. He did end up passing away about 6 years ago from a qualifying condition in Illinois. But over that time, we moved the legislation forward in terms of taking it from something that was much more patient friendly, and you know, it allowed patients to grow a certain number of plants, it allowed them to be in possession of a certain amount of cannabis. And over the course of a decade, every time we failed to pass this legislation, we made compromises. We eventually took out the right for patients to grow their own cannabis. I believe the bill that Larry McKeon was originally sponsoring allowed 12 plants. Eventually that went down to 6. Eventually that was 6, but only 3 could be mature. And then eventually it was no plants. And then we also saw some fluctuations in how many patients could participate in this program. At one point, the program was going to be limited to just 1,500 patients across the whole state.
What?
And this is where, you know, some of the political backroom conversations go, where, you know, we put that number in there so that it wouldn't be intimidating to the lawmakers or the law enforcement community.
Right.
But in the back of our minds was, as soon as we get to 1,500 patients, the next patient who applies and is denied because of this arbitrary number can sue the state of Illinois and say that this number is arbitrary, and hopefully, you know, the court case doesn't drag on, but the idea is that you sue, you don't actually win in court, but you win in the change in policy that you're looking for. But again, that never went through. Some of the other provisions that we had to eventually add or take out of this program would be things like the fingerprinting and background checks that patients have to go through in Illinois, the disqualification for anybody who's ever had a felony drug conviction or violent conviction of a felony crime. They're known as excluded offenses. Those are things that, you know, we didn't think that this was a great idea. Nobody wanted to see this be put in place, but eventually it was something that needed to be done in order to pass this law.
Mm-hmm.
Other limitations on who cannot participate in this program. Anybody with a CDL, a commercial driver's license, is not allowed to be a medical cannabis patient. Firefighters, EMTs, police officers, those are all folks who, just because of their profession, are not allowed to be medical cannabis patients according to the law in Illinois. And this is something that...
Hey, that's okay. They can just drink the pain away.
Yeah.
Gee whiz. Sorry, I just couldn't hold that back. Go ahead.
Well, and, you know, we tried to, you know, use a little bit of leverage in certain ways where we were trying to get one of the conditions added that would apply to a lot of law enforcement officers and firefighters with PTSD.
Yeah.
I mean, we know that veterans can benefit from this. We know that veterans are having a very difficult time coming home from all these foreign conflicts that we're sending them to. But it's not just veterans that have PTSD, it's firefighters and police officers. And we thought, well, you know, if we can get PTSD added as a qualifying condition, firefighters, police officers, they have colleagues that have PTSD. If those people start benefiting from medical cannabis, well, now we're starting to gain some inroads within those communities of law enforcement and the firefighters. But we still haven't been able to get PTSD added. One of the efforts that failed last year, was gonna add PTSD, and there was talk of just limiting that to veterans. We didn't like that because we know that it applies to all sorts of folks,
mm-hmm.
Especially victims of sexual assault.
Yes.
You know, that's something that we didn't want to exclude those individuals from participating in this program. But this is all part of the sausage making of politics, and we just still haven't been able to get that through. But back to the legislative process of what we were able to pass, eventually we were able to pass a medical cannabis law that has, as was also mentioned in my bio, a pilot aspect, a sunset clause. Originally, it was just going to be a 3-year pilot program. But then as we got closer to the bill passing, the lawmakers kind of knew that this was going to take about a year of bureaucracy to set up the rules and regulations, to draft the application process for patients, for cultivation centers, for dispensaries. And that's really where that first year of our 4-year pilot program went to, was that bureaucratic process. Some of the other aspects of the law that, you know, were put in place that, you know, none of us were exactly thrilled about, but it was something that was necessary, was limiting the amount of licenses that would be available. You know, we did tie into the state police districts where there was going to be one cultivation license for every state police district, of which there are 22 in the state. One of them just does the tollways, so we couldn't exactly put a cultivation center in a oasis, even though there was an oasis that was empty that I was thinking would have been great. But I guess the security protocol of having tens of thousands of vehicles drive underneath it wasn't something that the state thought was a good idea. But we do have 21 cultivation licenses that have been issued in Illinois. It was also mentioned that there are 60 dispensaries in the state. At one time, there were going to be 59 dispensaries, and it was going to be one per state Senate district.
Okay.
Well, somebody looked at that and said, this does not look good on paper. If you're tying a business license to a political office, it's going to smell of corruption. Even if there is no corruption, it just has that appearance. So they moved it up from from 59 to 60. And that's where you get, you know, essentially another arbitrary number of how many licenses. But, you know, the total licenses for businesses and medical cannabis in Illinois is 81. I believe out of those, 78 have been issued. There were still three districts for dispensaries that nobody applied for, that the state just hasn't opened up that application window again. One of them being the state police district just north of the Champaign-Urbana area, which includes Ford, Iroquois, and Kankakee County. And I've had conversations with the agency people that are in charge of this program, and I said, hey, you know, if you're looking to help folks in that area, open up that window for these three districts so that people can apply. You know, you'll have all sorts of lawyers making money first and foremost. You'll have all sorts of consultants making money. Real estate people will make a lot of money on the front end, you know, taking people around for different properties. But eventually you issue these licenses and you're going to create jobs in those parts of the state where, you know, we are having problems with finding people to bring investment dollars to Illinois. We're having problems with job creators. Here we are sitting on potential for job creators and entrepreneurs to, you know, invest money into these parts of the state, and yet the bureaucracy just doesn't want to open up these three licenses for another application window. The other ones would be in DeKalb County, and then the third one is South Township in Chicago, which is like the far south side of the city. But that's where we could create jobs tomorrow if they just opened up this application window. It doesn't take a change in law. It doesn't take anything other than, you know, the Department of Financial and Professional Regulation saying, okay, whoever wants to get one of these licenses, you got 2 weeks to apply, because that was the original window and they have to do another window that's the same time length. But that's where, you know, some of the aspects of the law that people just don't understand, like why can't I grow my own? Why am I excluded because I have this past offense that was, you know, sometimes 30 or 40 years ago, that are now denying people medicine. And this was another thing that I thought we could have solved through the courts, yet we haven't found any lawyers or organizations that are willing to go to bat for these patients, because to me, denying somebody access to medicine for a very arbitrary reason of they have a previous conviction for a crime that they've already done their time for, it seems like something that the courts would look at and side with the patients more than, you know, just this rule of law that is out there. But again, we haven't seen anybody who's been willing to take this up in court yet.
The thing that I find, infuriating really is the word. The thing that I find infuriating is those same folks being denied a natural medicine like cannabis because of a prior conviction sometimes decades ago. Let's just say it's chronic pain, they can go in and get prescription pills, which many of them are addictive. Go in and get that, no problem. And this is, to me, how does that make sense? It makes no sense to me.
Yeah, I mean, it's really something where you have to look at who's standing to gain and who is standing to benefit from these policies. And I should qualify that there is a certain provision in the law that if your felony conviction is for something that is now legal under the medical cannabis law, you can apply for a waiver and they can accept you into the program. But, you know, very few people know about that, and I'm not sure if anyone has even used that and been able to get accepted into this program. But back to the idea of, you know, treating chronic pain. Chronic pain isn't a qualifying condition in Illinois. There are different types.
It is in Ontario. Okay.
And that's another one that, you know, we knew was a big problem because in some states that makes up a majority of these cannabis patients.
Mm-hmm.
But if you look at the opioid epidemic that's going on in this country and in our state, you know, cannabis is something that is by far and away objectively safer than any of these pain pills. There has not been a documented overdose fatality from medical cannabis or cannabis recreationally used ever in the history of its usage. You know, whereas people are dying every single day from overdoses on not just pain pills, but other prescription medications, over-the-counter drugs. And I think that there's, a real disconnect in terms of the NIMBY idea of people don't want a medical cannabis dispensary in their neighborhood or in their town, but then they have no objection to these pharmacies that are opening up outside of every single suburban neighborhood. Every strip mall has, you know, one or two or sometimes three different types of dispensaries if you include the ones in the grocery stores. And a lot of the medications that they're putting into our community are the ones that are getting people addicted. And then, unfortunately, people that are struggling with these addiction to the pills, they can no longer afford the high-priced pills, so they move on to the cheaper and albeit more potent street drugs. And that's where we have a lot of these overdose fatalities that are occurring. I think that if medical cannabis would be a option for a lot of these patients, you would see that they would prefer it because it doesn't have the long-term negative side effects like destroying your liver and kidneys like most opioid-based pain pills do. You don't have the tolerance buildup, which is also a big factor in why so many overdose fatalities occur, because somebody's used to taking a number of pills to treat their pain. They go a week without having to take any pills because they're feeling fine. And then the next weekend, they're feeling pain again, so they take that same amount of pills that they were previously taking, and their tolerance has dropped down so much that now they have an overdose. And if no one's around, that can be a fatal overdose. Yeah. You know, and in states where medical cannabis is legal, they've had a study now that has shown a 25% decrease in overdose fatalities.
Wow.
And that's a significant amount of lives that are, yes, being saved or not lost, however you want to phrase it. And all of that is because you have a natural product that doesn't have the same list of side effects. It doesn't have the same long-term problematics of usage. Yet you have this skepticism of it. You have this stigma around who uses medical cannabis, and you really have a reluctance in the medical community. And that's something that I'd like to talk about with our Illinois program, because a lot of people recently have been talking about how the Illinois program is doomed to fail, or there's just not the patient numbers that everybody thought there was. And a lot of that has to do with the medical community being resistant or in some cases prevented from writing these recommendations for medical cannabis.
So, okay, so chronic pain is not one of the eligible conditions. I don't expect you to name all of them because aren't there about 60?
There's 39.
Oh, 39.
You can call it 37 depending on, because some of them are like subsets of another condition.
Okay.
I mean, some of them are, you know, real obvious conditions that people are familiar with: cancer, glaucoma, multiple sclerosis, Parkinson's disease. And then there's some more obscure ones like chronic regional pain syndrome, nail catchia, nail patella, I think it's also called. But there's 39 specific qualifying conditions that patients must have in order to qualify for this program. One of the things about those conditions is that, and this is something that came from the legislative debate, all of them are extremely verifiable conditions. Because the lawmakers in Illinois saw how other states had medical cannabis programs where, you know, in California, a doctor can recommend medical cannabis for any condition. You know, they trust their doctors. They license their doctors. If a doctor thinks this is beneficial for the patient's treatment, the patient can have access to this medicine. In Illinois, the lawmakers said there's just a bunch of people faking conditions and getting access to this, and they see California in a lot of ways as a de facto legalization state. So those conditions are in this law because they're extremely verifiable, and there was the idea that you couldn't really fake having cancer, or nobody's going to go out and actively try and get HIV or AIDS so that they can get access to cannabis. You know, those were kind of some of the logic of where these conditions came from, along with a somewhat significant amount of data saying that these conditions can be properly treated with medical cannabis.
So that really does, to me, convey a serious lack of trust in the physicians in Illinois to practice ethically.
Yeah, and other aspects of the law are evident of that too. There's language that requires the patient to have a bona fide patient-doctor relationship. And again, this comes from these you know, clinics in California where you have the dispensary in one room and the doctor's offices in the other, and all he does is write these recommendations all day long. It's a very for-profit business model of medicine in California. Illinois did not want to see that take place. They require the patient to have this bona fide patient-doctor relationship, which is extremely vague and ambiguous.
I was going to say, how do you? What does that mean? You've seen them so many times?
There isn't any real threshold of you have to have seen the doctor for this amount of time or this amount of visits.
Okay.
And I think the state was somewhat good in this because they realized that patients switch doctors. Sometimes doctors move. Sometimes patients move. Sometimes doctors die. And you just can't. You know, you got to start a new relationship with a new doctor, so why would you have to, you know, prevent that doctor from being able to write this recommendation and pursue this treatment? Another aspect is that doctors cannot have any type of financial interests in any of these businesses if they're writing medical cannabis recommendations. It's an either or. I mean, you can be a doctor and own one of these businesses, but you can't write recommendations. Or you can be a doctor, not have any financial stake, and write these recommendations. So that's where they, you know, again, they, you know, it seems pretty clear they didn't trust the doctors to perform this ethical duty of treating these patients.
Okay, I'm going to take a moment again to do some pitching for pledges. And you are listening to WEFT 90.1 FM in Champaign and streaming online at weft.org. And you are... If you're hearing us right now, it's because people who listen contribute money. That's the only way that we stay on the air. We are community supported, volunteer operated, and because of that, without your financial support, we don't exist anymore. Our spring pledge drive has a goal of $30,000. We are almost a third of the way there. We really need you to continue to give us your support, give us your financial support. It's great that if you go around and tell your friends, hey, I listened to this really great radio station, you got to listen to it. We appreciate that. But we also need something more tangible, and that's your dollars. Without your dollars, this station goes off the air. It is really that simple. So you can call 359-6545. We have folks that are available to take your call. You can also go to weft.org and pledge online. You can also stop by if you want to. We are at 113 North Market Street, downtown Champaign. If you're going to stop by, it's best that you stop by during regular business hours, and there will be folks around that will be happy to take your pledge in cash or check or credit card. This is important, I believe, anyway, important that we have this kind of a voice in our community that's giving you alternative views, I suppose, things that kind of news that you're not going to hear, kinds of public affairs programming that you're not going to hear on commercial radio, locally produced, and we can't do it without you. So please give us a call or go online, weft.org or 359-6545, and make your pledge. If not right this minute, soon. Okay, a question I have for you, Dan, is if you could please describe for a person who is a patient and is considering the use of medical cannabis, what does that person need to do in the state of Illinois?
The first step would be to talk to their doctor, and it should be your doctor. There are issues if your doctor is unwilling or unable to write a recommendation, you will need to find a new doctor. But assuming your doctor is okay with it and you have one of the qualifying conditions, the doctor will fill out a form and the doctor will mail that form to the Illinois Department of Public Health. The patient needs to fill out their own application. That can be done with a paper application and mail. That can also be done online. And then the patient needs to go and get fingerprinted and have that live scan fingerprint vendor receipt number as part of the patient's application. They submit that along with a $100 fee. Unless they're a veteran or on low income, then it's $50. And when they submit all of those documents to the state of Illinois, the state has 30 days to turn around and either approve or deny the condition or the patient to be participating in the program. If there are any deficiencies in the application, the Department of Public Health will send a letter to the patient letting them know that there's a deficiency and they have, I believe, 60 days to correct that deficiency. Once when they are approved for the program, they get a letter in the mail. Eventually they will get an ID card in the mail. Usually in that first letter in the mail, they will get a form that has them designate a medical cannabis dispensary, because they can't just go to any medical cannabis dispensary. They need to be registered to a specific one. They are allowed to change, but they do need to let the state know that they are changing, and that process takes about 24 hours. But then assuming they register with a specific dispensary, once when they get their card, then they can go to that dispensary and purchase up to 2.5 ounces every 14 days. There are different increments of if they're purchasing an edible or a concentrate, how much that will be reflected in that 2.5 ounce limit. But that's really the gist of how they would enroll in this program and get access to the medicine.
And that's something that's available now.
Correct.
You can do that right now.
Yeah. There is a website that the state of Illinois has set up. They also have a FAQ, frequently asked questions, and tip sheet in terms of, you know, tips for going through this process. The state's website is mcpp.illinois.gov, G-O-V, and that's mcpp.illinois.gov, MCPP as in Medical Cannabis Pilot Program.
Okay. If you could please expand a little bit on the different forms. You kind of intimated it just now, but what are some of the forms that medical cannabis comes in?
Well, most people are familiar with the idea of smoking cannabis. That's obviously one way that patients administer this medicine. It does have the benefit of having a little bit more of an instant onset in terms of patients can feel the effects of it immediately, which makes it a little bit easier to titrate the dosage. And if patients don't want to do the actual smoking, there's another method through vaporization that's very similar. It's like a lot of the e-cigarettes that people see these days where, it's inhaled, so it's administered through the lungs, but it's not heated to the point of combustion like smoking is. It's heated, just below that, and that releases the cannabinoids into the bloodstream via the lungs. Other than smoking and vaporization, there's things like edibles. Most people have heard or are familiar with the idea of cannabis brownies. In Illinois, I don't think there's any brownies on the market yet, but there's chocolates and, gummies and other things like that. There's also topical salves and, patches that can be used. There's pills that are just capsules that have ground cannabis in them. There's oils that can be used sublingually under the tongue. There's also tinctures, which are an old-fashioned form of medicine, which is like an eyedropper of liquid that they can use. And I believe one of the cultivation centers is also producing suppositories. So if anybody's interested in suppositories, I believe that they are on the market now for Illinois medical cannabis patients.
Okay. One thing that a comment that I have heard from a couple of people here in Illinois is there's a distrust. There's this sense that, okay, this is a pilot program, so that means it could go away. And if I become a registered medical cannabis user and it goes away, now the government has a list, and I'm going to liken this. It's a stretch, I realize, but I'm going to liken it to the culture clubs in pre-Nazi Germany. Pre-Nazi Germany had very liberal attitudes about homosexuality. There were culture clubs where gay men, of course. There was nothing even mentioned about lesbians because women are always invisible. But anyway, there were culture clubs where gay men were able to gather socially, and there were membership roles. And then when the Nazis took power, those were used to round up gay men and, you know, got the special little pink triangle on their uniforms, etc. I realize that's a stretch, but there's that sort of concern that if I register now and this goes away, now they know that I use and I'm going to be a target for scrutiny that I wouldn't have been before. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I'm not going to discount someone's fears. You know, if people have that fear, I'm not going to tell them that they don't have that fear. What I would say is that it's highly unlikely that this program will go away. You know, now that we have almost 5,000 patients enrolled in this program, that's a very strong voice at the Capitol with lawmakers. There's also an industry now where you have $250 million invested in these businesses in Illinois.
I'm going to take a call. Oh, I think that might have been a pledge call. Okay. Sorry. Go ahead.
But I mean, I think that the, you know, the worst case scenario is that this program does not be, is not renewed. You know, there is this potential list of patients that were enrolled in it. I think that there would be some type of violation of patient privacy, access there. I think that you could also hope for some type of prosecutorial discretion of, you know, not going after these people on the level, even if they were arrested by some rogue law enforcement officer or county sheriff, you know, the prosecutors really have the ultimate authority whether or not to pursue those charges. I think the real idea is that, you know, these patients are patients. They're not criminals. You know, even if this law was reversed, you still have people who are suffering from these conditions, and they should not be punished for their suffering and for trying to choose a medicine that that gives them relief. You know, now the businesses are a completely different story. You know, they're doing something that's legal now. If the law changes and they're doing something illegal, and they continue that activity, you know, clearly they're breaking a law. You know, there's going to be much less sympathy for them. Mm-hmm. But for medical cannabis patients, you know, even if they were still in possession of medical cannabis or if they started growing their own medicine, I think that there's been enough of a awareness campaign. I think there's enough support for medical cannabis as a concept in Illinois. A poll that came out just this week, I think put it up in 80% of people, 4 out of 5 support medical cannabis in Illinois. So you'd really have to find some people who are in positions of power who are very antagonistic towards this medicine and the individuals who are benefiting from it to go after those folks. Plus, these patients would still have to be breaking the law.
Right.
You know, you can't go in and charge somebody for participating in this pilot program if they don't have any medical cannabis on them anymore once when the law changes. So I know that there is that fear out there. I would encourage patients to enroll in this program because the more patients there are, the more likely it is going to be renewed. And if patients are currently breaking the law, there is nothing that can that we can do to help them. You know, if they do enroll in this program and they you know, somewhere down the road get arrested for being in possession of cannabis, at least they have this documentation that their doctor supports their usage of this product.
Right, right. I'm going to mention that you are listening to The Midwatch, and my name is Nisi Shizenji, and I am sitting in for Reasonable Man Stan. My guest is Dan Lynn, a leading cannabis activist in the state of Illinois, currently the general manager and national policy director for Phoenix Botanicals, which is a medical marijuana dispensary. And he knows cannabis inside and out and knows the law. And hopefully you're learning a lot. And I hope there are folks out there who can benefit from legal medical cannabis who will be encouraged to undergo the process of obtaining a card and hopefully begin to get relief using a natural product that does not carry the dangers that many of the prescription pills do. That leads me to a question of wondering about major pharma. Are they putting up a fight, or are they trying to get in on production, or what's happening there?
Well, I haven't. I mean, there definitely wasn't any obvious resistance at the state level when we were working on this legislation from the big pharma. Obviously, they're interested in medicines. I think the difference here is that with cannabis, and specifically the cannabinoids that make up this material and have the medical properties, I mean, Big Pharma is already synthesizing and producing a pill that includes one cannabinoid, THC. There's a pill that's 100% THC other than a few binders that are in it. But it just doesn't have the same impact and benefits as herbal cannabis does. And what the studies are starting to show is there's something known as an entourage effect, where it's the synergistic effects of these different cannabinoids with each other that allow for the benefits to be felt by the patient to treat certain symptoms. The body has an endocannabinoid system. All mammals do, for that matter. Doesn't matter if you've never smoked cannabis before in your life, you have this system in your body. It modulates other systems like the central nervous system, the digestive system, and there are two receptors in the endocannabinoid system, a CB1 receptor and a CB2 receptor, and these cannabinoids end up fitting into these receptors sort of like a key into a lock. And because these receptors are found throughout the body and different cannabinoids activate the different receptors, that's why cannabis is beneficial for so many different conditions and for so many different people. Now, Big Pharma has an issue and problem replicating the herbal product because they need to synthesize not just different cannabinoids, but different levels of them in the different strains of cannabis, because cannabis is a plant, and like other plants like grapes or tomatoes, there's different varieties, and the different varieties have different flavors and different levels and profiles of these cannabinoids. So Big Pharma is having an issue replicating that in the lab. The other thing, and this is the bigger one, cannabis is still illegal federally. It's a Schedule I substance. So Big Pharma can't exactly just start massively producing this tomorrow, even if they wanted to. They probably could pull some strings to get it off of the scheduling from the FDA, but that's a conversation for another day. But I don't see any real threat from Big Pharma for this, because Big Pharma is not selling herbal cannabinoids. They're only selling the synthesized and standardized ones, whereas those just reportedly aren't working as well as the herbal ones for patients that are seeking this medicine.
Okay. Now, I read that just last month, Dr. Nirav Shah, the director of the Illinois Health Department, shot down an attempt to add post-traumatic stress disorder, irritable bowel syndrome, autism, osteoarthritis, several pain-related conditions to the list of allowable conditions. And these are ones that the state's own Medical Cannabis Advisory Board had recommended be added to the list. So what happens now?
Well, there are two mechanisms for adding more conditions to this program. One is through petitioning that Medical Cannabis Advisory Board, which is made up of doctors, a couple patients, and nurses. The other method is through the legislative process, and that was the one that we tried adding PTSD through last year unsuccessfully. We were successful in adding epilepsy and other seizure disorders through the legislative process. Okay. And the big part of that bill that allowed for epilepsy and seizure disorders to be included in this program was that it also included minors in the program. The original legislation, and again, this is something that was eventually compromised, did not include minors. Nobody was happy about this. Nobody felt that, well, somebody who is 16 or 17 and has cancer can't get medicine until they turn 18. You know, that doesn't make any sense. The big difference from the time that the bill passed that allowed this program to exist versus the bill that passed to add epilepsy and seizure disorders in minors is that there was a CNN special by Dr. Sanjay Gupta highlighting epileptic children who were having up to 100 seizures per day, getting a high concentration of CBD oil, which is another cannabinoid. And that CBD oil, just a little pea-sized, you know, droplet under their tongue, could reduce their seizures dramatically. You know, going from 100 a day down to less than 5 a day, in some cases no seizures. And that dramatically improves that child's quality of life. It dramatically improves the parent's quality of life. It allows these kids to function. But that nationally televised segment opened the world up to the idea of medical cannabis, and it removed a lot of those stereotypes and stigmas of, you know, the Jeff Spicolis of the world who want medical cannabis so that they can get high. You know, here you have these, you know, tragic situations of these young kids suffering from these intractable seizures, benefiting from this natural medicine, and parents in a lot of cases moving from a state that does not have a medical program to a state like Colorado in order to get access to this medicine. And I can tell you that we had parents whose families were torn apart testifying at committees at the Capitol about how the husband and the child had to move to Colorado to get access to the medicine, but the mother had to stay in Illinois and keep working so that she could have health insurance for the family. And that was where, you know, that resistance from law enforcement that I talked about in the beginning, they never showed up when it came to these parents, specifically these mothers of these epileptic children.
Yeah.
And we were able to, you know, get that bill passed in a slam dunk type of fashion.
Yes.
And again, that was what allowed not just epileptic children to participate in this program, but also minors in general. So kids with leukemia and other forms of cancer can now participate in this program.
You'd have to have literally a heart of stone to oppose that. I mean, that's children suffering that yeah. could be helped. That's
and again, you know, just kind of, you know, give the image of what the committee hearing was like. You know, years past, you'd have the law enforcement officers and they show up in their full formal dress and garments, you know, talking about how, you know, this medicine's going to end up on the playgrounds and in every school in Illinois if we allow it. And then we pass the law. We have mothers with epileptic children now showing up at a committee hearing and they're all wearing purple for the Epilepsy Foundation. You know, and there's a lot of these epileptic children in the room. One of the kids actually had a seizure during the hearing. And after the parents got up and testified, you know, they asked for the opposition to testify and nobody in the room walked up there. Nobody showed up. I mean, it was literally like everyone's looking behind them. Okay, who's going to come up and call these parents liars or who's going to say these kids don't deserve access to this medicine? And they just never did.
Yeah.
And again, it was such a night and day difference in the tone, both from the lawmakers as well as just everybody in that building about how this is a medicine and it is helping these kids because nobody wants to see these kids suffer like they were with these seizures at the levels that they were having them.
Absolutely. Can you share other, obviously I'm not asking you to name names, but just share other kind of success stories that you've seen, people that, patients that have benefited, whose quality of life has been dramatically improved?
Yeah, a lot of patients, and this is just kind of a generalization, you know, they have such a problem with the pharmaceutical drugs that they're taking, the side effects of them, living in sort of a haze where, you know, they're not fully there with their families. You know, some people have reported that, you know, because of the amount of opioids they were taking, they can't remember any of their kids' high school experiences. And then once when they start taking medical cannabis, they're able to reduce this pharmaceutical load so much now that they're able to function. You know, there have been, you know, a couple of multiple sclerosis patients who are basically bound to a wheelchair. They start using medical cannabis. Now they can use a walker.
Wow.
You know, I mean, they're not out running marathons, but that's still a big improvement from being wheelchair bound to now being able to use a walker to get around.
That's
huge. You know, an apartment or a condo. And then to share a story of one patient who, kind of a success story, kind of a sad story. He had what's known as residual limb pain, phantom limb pain, where you have an amputee, but you still have pain in that limb that no longer exists. That was not an originally qualifying condition in some of those early versions of the bill. But eventually we were able to have that condition added because he contacted his state representative. The state representative met with him at his house, talked to him for, I believe it was 2 hours, and his significant other, you know, clearly showed, you know, this is what I'm taking in terms of my pharmaceutical drugs. You know, I'm already breaking the law by using cannabis. I don't think I should be a criminal. Please, you know, help me here. And that lawmaker ended up advocating to add that condition specifically for that patient. There was one other patient that suffered from that was pretty active at that time. But that was where that residual limb pain kind of got included at the last minute into the original list of conditions was, you know, that one voice reaching out to that one lawmaker. And it was a sympathetic enough story that that one lawmaker, who previously I'll say was a no vote on medical cannabis,
wow,
not only became a yes vote on medical cannabis, but also we need to specifically do this for this individual. And when that bill was signed by Governor Quinn into law, that gentleman was there. He had his picture taken with the governor. However, unfortunately, before medicine ever became available in Illinois, he passed away from complications from a few things. But, you know, he advocated for the law. He advocated for this condition to be added. But he never did end up benefiting from this program that he helped work for.
But there's a legacy there.
Yeah.
Of what his efforts and what he did are. It's going to benefit other people who have the same condition. So.
Yeah. And that's why I say, you know, reaching out to your state representative and your state senator, they're very accessible. You know, when I talk to people about engaging the political process, you know, they're confused about, you know, who's in Washington, D.C. versus who's in Springfield. The people in Washington, D.C. are not very accessible. I mean, you'll talk to a staff member if you have a meeting with them. But the state reps and the state senators, they're accessible. They live in your neighborhood or your area. I mean, the way that they have that representation in Illinois, it's, you know, these people are there to represent you. So let your voice be known.
You know, as you were talking about that gentleman with the phantom limb pain and sharing his story, and what it made me think of was that the original criminalization had so much to do with dehumanizing users of cannabis.
Yeah.
And that in order to successfully get this law passed in Illinois, it was a process of humanizing, seeing the actual faces of people whose lives are so compromised in one way or another by a medical condition, who are being helped by a natural substance and ought not and don't want to be considered as criminals. It's that process of humanizing, rehumanizing an entire group of people. That seems to me is kind of the crux of what you're describing.
Yeah, and you know, it's a sad day when you have sick people who go to the Capitol to talk to their elected officials and they're met with this questionable stare of, are you really that sick? Or are you just trying to fool me so that I'll let you get high? You know, that was something that was a very real situation for us at the Capitol. And that's why I said, like, it took us 10 years to allow sick and dying people to have access to a plant. I never thought it was going to take that long. I thought this was, you know, 2 or 3 years of showing them science, 2 or 3 years of showing them, you know, what's going on in other states with how these patients are benefiting. You know, get out of the way of medicine, you know, let doctors and patients have that, you know, privacy and choose what treatment is better for them. And the political process, you know, it took us 10 years.
Bless you for hanging in there, really, you know, because a lesser person would have just given up, honestly.
I mean, there definitely were patients who moved to other states, you know, other advocates who moved to other states. You know, some people, you know, died.
Yes.
You know, I mean, when your comrades and colleagues in this effort are, you know, moving or dying, you know, you need other people to step up. And luckily there were people who, you know, eventually got the courage to start making the trip to Springfield or just calling their state rep regularly, letting them know that this is important to them, you know, starting to get on the email list of a state representative and then just showing up at their events and saying, I'm here to answer any questions that you or somebody else may have about medical cannabis. You know, I'm living proof that this is a medicine and that this works. And, because of brave individuals like that, we were able to pass this law. It's a very imperfect law. There's definitely room for improvement, but, you know, you always need to be willing to compromise in politics. You can't be an all or nothing because you're always going to end up with nothing.
Right.
You know, for us, you know, the pilot program, you know, there's days where I'm proud that, you know, I was a part of that process. And then there's days where I'm thinking, you know, this could just blow up in all of our faces.
Yeah.
But at the same time, we needed to get access to this medicine for these individuals. We needed to take them out of the criminal element. And, that's where we are now in Illinois. You know, our medical cannabis dispensary here in Champaign is probably going to be opening in early April.
Okay.
We're doing an event on March 20th at the Champaign Public Library from 2 to 4 p.m. It's a free event that patients can come and learn more about medical cannabis. Community members, anyone who is interested in learning more about our dispensary, we just want to let the community in the Champaign-Urbana area know who we are, what we're about, and not be afraid of this shop that we're opening up and this medicine. Right. You know, this is something that people need to learn more about, and we're going to be there to answer any questions. And if patients are interested in enrolling in this program, we're going to have people there that can help get them in that process, because we know it's a very cumbersome process and it's not easy to manage on your own. So we're there to, you know, literally hold people's hands and make sure that they can get enrolled in this program if they want to and their doctor thinks it's the right treatment for them.
Again, that's March 20th from 2 to 4 p.m. at the Champaign Public Library. And I would certainly urge anybody who feels they could benefit, please show up. become educated, get some assistance, and, you know, maybe you will be able to get some relief in less than a month's time.
Yeah, and we're also hiring. So if people want to get a job or learn more about the career opportunities that we have, show up with a resume and be ready to impress us, because we know there's a lot of people that want to get involved in this industry. And we can make all sorts of pot jokes about it's a budding industry, it's a growing industry. The pot jokes never stop with this, but you know, we are hiring, so if people are interested in getting a job or even just learning more about what opportunities exist, I'd be happy to talk to them about it.
Okay. I have a question, and that is, do you see medical marijuana paving the way for legalization of the recreational and spiritual use of marijuana?
There was a time where I would be forced to say I don't, but I'm no longer under those contractual bounds. So yes, I do think that it will, specifically because of the ability for it to remove the stigma around the plant itself, the consumers of this plant, the industry of who is involved in the production and distribution of this plant. Again, you know, getting back to the beginning of the show, if we look at why we made this plant illegal, that's an injustice. And we need to right that wrong. And if medical cannabis is a first step in righting that wrong, I'm perfectly fine admitting that that is the first step and that is a step that we should be taking. I mean, if we wanted to create many more jobs than what, you know, Phoenix Botanical is able to create in Champaign-Urbana, we would legalize cannabis. I mean, if you talk about a cash crop that Illinois farmers could be growing right now, I don't think you're going to find many other crops other than maybe something like saffron that get the legal retail price of, you know, $200 to $400 an ounce or $2,000 to $3,000 a pound. You're definitely not getting that for a bushel of corn or a bushel of soy. And cannabis is something that farmers in Illinois should have the option of growing. They should be also able to grow industrial hemp. These are things that I think are relics of a era of racism in our political process. I think that the residual effects of that racism are still very real in parts of this country, and especially in central Illinois. And I think that the sooner that we can end another failed prohibition, the sooner we'll be able to have a legal and regulated market for this product, the easier it'll be for us to keep it out of the hands of children and teenagers who we don't want using it. The quality controls will be there. The tax revenue will be there from a legalized market. And you know, we're talking about jobs and investments and a boost to our economy here. $250 million were invested in the medical cannabis industry in Illinois for this pilot program. That's what's really going to make this pilot program a permanent program.
Right.
5,000 patients is a loud voice. $250 million at the state capitol, unfortunately, is a louder voice than those 5,000 patients, in my opinion.
Yeah.
And I think that that's where, you know, ending this prohibition on cannabis is something that we need to do for so many reasons, the least of which is the money, the biggest of which is righting a wrong in terms of a bad law that we still have on the books.
That's an article that, as I was preparing for the show, I came across an article from 2013 that was in The Economist. And it's entitled Marijuana Legislation Leveraging Racism. And it talked about how at first the conversation about legalizing was coming from the medical angle, mm-hmm. medical cannabis angle. And that now it is coming from that growing recognition, first of all, of the roots of the criminalization and the recognition that the racism and the enforcement of these laws that is still rampant, and that that makes no sense. I think the other part of this as well, we're seeing, I think, increasingly, even in the mainstream media, real reporting of scientific data as opposed to hysterical, overblown myths, basically. And the real data is, as you mentioned earlier, there's never been a single overdose.
Overdose fatality.
Fatality, yes. People, well, the things I came across anyway, it's pretty clear that the use of alcohol and tobacco are having a far greater negative impact on the United States in terms of medical costs, in terms of lost productivity, in terms of deaths. I mean, this is, I guess, the thing that has always puzzled me. We now have absolutely no doubt, zero doubt, that tobacco is a product that kills its consumers, period. It does.
Yeah.
And it's legal.
Yeah. But I think that's where it's also good to have that historical perspective of, you know, this country was founded on the tobacco industry in a lot of ways. You know, the Virginia colony, was, you know, a tobacco producing colony. And I do agree that tobacco and alcohol are very dangerous substances. I try not to paint cannabis as this cure-all substance that, you know, nobody could possibly ever abuse. I do think that cannabis abuse does exist. I don't think it's nearly as detrimental to the consumer or the non-consuming public as alcohol or tobacco. But if you look at how we've been able to curtail underage cigarette smoking through an honest education campaign and not these scare tactics like this is your brain on drugs and it's an egg frying in a pan. You know, that's how we're going to be better able as a society to deter young people from engaging in these dangerous activities, whether it's substance use or whether it's other, you know, just dangerous activities. I think that the other aspect of looking at alcohol and tobacco is that, yes, they are dangerous, but no, they probably should not be illegal because we should allow adults in this country to make adult decisions, even if they're bad decisions.
Exactly.
You know, we do pride ourselves on our freedoms and our liberties, and whether it's alcohol or tobacco or cannabis, you know, let adults make these adult decisions and do what they want with their mind and their body. You know, absent harm to others, there should be no criminal penalties for that. You know, once when you start harming others, once when you start endangering others or negligent to your kids, you know, that's when the state should come in and have certain penalties or protocols for punishing somebody.
Yes.
But the responsible cannabis consumer should not be treated any differently than the responsible alcohol or tobacco consumer, in my mind.
Yeah, I agree. I certainly don't think prohibition is the answer for any of those substances. I agree. Adults, make your own choices. And frankly, anything can be abused.
Exactly.
Anything can be abused. Yeah. Food is something that is, and that's a whole other topic, the stuff that gets marketed and sold to us as food may be edible, but it isn't actually serving the purpose that food is supposed to be serving,
which nutritious.
Which is nourishing your body. That's what food is supposed to do. And an awful lot of what we consume doesn't do that. But that's okay. That's a choice we get to make. But we can abuse ourselves in multiple ways. And if we were to try to go around and criminalize every possible way we can abuse ourselves, you can abuse yourself with sex for crying out loud. It makes no sense. Criminalization doesn't make sense.
And I think it's also something about refocusing our law enforcement priorities. You know, every time a law enforcement officer is busy arresting a nonviolent cannabis grower or possessor, that's less time that they're out there solving a murder, solving a sexual assault. Somebody's car got broken into. They could be investigating that. There's plenty of other crimes that go unsolved that there is a direct victim of that crime. You know, the nonviolent, responsible cannabis consumer, it's tough to find a victim in that case.
Yes.
And, you know, if there's a family member who's, you know, being negligent, you know, then we have certain protocols for negligent parents. You know, we can follow those rules. You know, we have rules on driving sobriety. Mm-hmm. You know, there's ways for us to allow cannabis to be legal, yet keep our roads safe from people that are intoxicated driving. But until all these other violent crimes are solved, it should be outrageous for us to allow law enforcement officers to go after these, what really are just low-hanging fruit. You know,
yes.
Catching college kids smoking pot is a very easy crime for a law enforcement officer to find and solve. You know, solving a cold case murder or a burglary, that takes real police work. That's a much more difficult job. But, you know, when our law enforcement priorities are, you know, built on increasing the amount of stats in terms of arrests, you know, that's why we have these skewered, priorities in the law enforcement community of going after nonviolent drug offenders and specifically cannabis consumers.
So I wanted to talk about the consequences of legalization in Colorado, Alaska, Oregon, Washington. There were predictions. The naysayers predicted an increase in crime, including violent crime. I'd like to talk about what has been the reality for those economies in those states, as well as crime rates.
Well, the data that I've seen specifically with Denver and Colorado is that crime has dropped significantly.
Yeah.
The tax revenue in Colorado is doing great things for their school system. I believe Denver was just ranked one of the best cities to live in the country. How much of that is attributed to the legalized cannabis? I'm not sure, but I bet you poll the people, they're happy to live in Denver. You know, I think that that's something that you're always going to find the naysayers who want to tell you that the sky is going to fall if we do this policy or if we do that policy. The sky hasn't fallen in any of those states. I think you could make an argument about what's going on in Washington, D.C., but their legalized cannabis industry isn't as robust or very similar to some of those other states. Colorado does allow for individuals to grow their own. Washington State does not. Washington, D.C. does not allow for retail sales of cannabis, so it's more of a farmer's market model. I think in those states that have legalized cannabis, there hasn't been any of the real fearful things happening that some of the people predicted. I have seen statistics about driving fatalities in Colorado going up significantly. Some of those statistics, though, are somewhat loaded because they don't separate people who just have cannabis in their system from those who have cannabis and alcohol in their system. The data on having both substances in your system is not good in terms of your ability to drive an automobile.
Right.
But if you're going to, you know, just highlight the statistics of driving fatalities and not break down the numbers, you know, you will find that there has been a little bit of an uptick in Colorado. I don't think that it's something that is significant enough, though, to have the voters in Colorado overturn their legalization law. I don't think the politicians are trying to overturn their legalization law in Colorado to any deal of success. You know, people in Oregon and Alaska and Washington State, you know, this is an industry that is emerging from the shadows. You have what was once a criminal element now becoming legitimate business people, just like we saw with alcohol prohibition. You know, you took these people out of that underground marketplace, forced them to become business folks and abide by certain business laws and regulations. And they probably will because there's that profit motive that they want to get at.
Sure.
There is always going to be an illegal market for these substances. You see a lot of a gray market in Colorado where people are growing it and then they're selling it to people who are then just trafficking it out of state. How you prevent that, I don't know until all these other states have legal cannabis as well. We see a underground market in alcohol sales with people that are avoiding tariffs from the bringing in Italian or Spanish wines. You know, you see the same thing with tobacco where people are, you know, not paying the tax stamps on it, or they're selling loose cigarettes instead of a cigarettes in a full pack. But all of these things are no reason for us to go back to a prohibition on those substances, or on cannabis, I guess I should be more specific with. You know, there are always going to be issues with any type of legalized substance or activity. It's just how much of a negative impact is it, and does that force any type of real political change?
I frankly have been kind of surprised, given the kinds of really positive results in Colorado, for example, in terms of the revenue that's been generated and not an increase in crime that some people, I've been so surprised that like every state in the union didn't just jump on that and say, you know what? Wow, we could use those revenues. Our schools certainly could use that kind of influx of money. I've been kind of shocked, honestly, that.
Yeah. I mean, I think in this upcoming election in November, you'll see a very real effort in California to legalize cannabis, Nevada, I believe Massachusetts also has a good chance of legalizing cannabis. I was predicting that Maine would, but I know they just had problems with one of the notaries for their petitions. I think Rhode Island has a very good chance of passing legalization through the legislature, as does Vermont. So those would probably be the first two states to pass legalization through a general assembly. But if you look at the history again with alcohol prohibition really didn't come crumbling down until New York and Chicago got on board with it. And they just said, we're not going to enforce this federal law anymore. And that's something to keep in mind with cannabis prohibition, is that while cannabis is still illegal federally, even though we have a state legal medical program in Illinois, the vast majority, and I'm talking like 95% of cannabis arrests are by a state or local law enforcement officer. It's not by a federal DEA agent.
Right.
So, I mean, if you're looking at how you're going to most positively impact your own ability to consume this product, changing a state law is the way to go. And then when enough states have changed their law, eventually the feds hopefully will follow suit. I mean, right now we have 23 states with medical cannabis laws on the book. You have four states plus the District of Columbia with recreational cannabis on the books. I predict that, you know, once when we get around 26 or 27 states with medical cannabis, you'll see that scheduling change, whether it goes from Schedule 1 to 2, or Schedule 1 to 3, or just becomes descheduled completely. That's yet to be determined, but I would think that we're within 5 years of seeing that federal scheduling change.
I'm just, we're coming rapidly to the, closing of the program. The time has gone very quickly for me. I've found this very absorbing, very interesting conversation, and I really appreciate that. Do you have any kind of final words that you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, if people want to get more information about the medical cannabis dispensary that's going to be opening at 1704 South Neal Street, which is called Phoenix Botanical, they can go to the website, which is still somewhat under construction, but it does exist. It's phoenixbotanical.net. We are doing the event at the Champaign Public Library on March 20th from 2 to 4 p.m. It is a free event that you can learn more about our medical cannabis dispensary and medical cannabis itself. Otherwise, if people have any other questions, they can find out how to get in touch with me at that website. And my last word would be, if people don't agree with this law or any law, contact your state representative and state senator and let them know that you feel that. That's what they're elected to do. And even if you don't vote, which I think everyone should vote, they're still there to represent you. But they'll definitely take your opinion a lot more serious if you tell them you're registered to vote.
Okay, awesome. And my guest has been Dan Lynn, and he has educated me, and hopefully you've learned a lot about the process, the 10-year-long fight, really, to gain the legalization of medical cannabis in Illinois. And we are wrapping up. I'm going to, in my last minute, say, please make sure that you make a pledge to WEFT. You can call 359-6545. You can go to weft.org and make a pledge. Stand by. We have Big Al's community chat coming right up. And I'm just going to close it out with a little bit of music. And then it's one of those pieces of music that I talked about possibly playing earlier from the 1930s. This is the Harlem Ham Fats. And I'm going to just let it play, and then Big Al's going to come in, sit down, and start talking whenever he wants to. Thanks, Dan.
Thank you.
Sitting on a million, sitting on it every day. Can't make no money giving your stuff away. Why don't you do now? Like a millionaire. Put your stuff on the market and make a million too. She's a betting woman, bets on every hand. She's a tricking mother for you every Why is she lying? Why don't you do now? Like the millionaire. Put your cup on the market and make a million too.